Produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Preston Frazier and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 481. Yes Tracks Through Time, Yes Songs.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 481 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site yesmusicpodcast.com. So we'll be coming back to that Yes Track Through Time from Yes Songs a little bit later on. On the YMP Facebook page this week, Preston Frazier posted his opinion that Man on the Moon, which features as a hidden track on the Conspiracy album we talked about last week, is, and I quote, on the same level as Talking with Siri. And that's from the Arc of Life album. Actually, I rather like them both, so we will agree to differ. Preston also added the Something Else interview from 2013, in which John Anderson talks about a few key moments from his career, including the key Yes tracks from Close to the Edge and the Yes album. Interesting stuff. Dave Fagan spotted the Prog magazine article on Arc of Life, in which they have to point out once again that they are not Yes. It's a tricky one to get over when four out of five of your band members are so clearly linked to our favourite band, but they are, of course, absolutely right. Daniel Crone spotted an interview with Oliver Wakeman about his keyboard setup, and Alan White announced that he's offering some great Yes memorabilia in support of a non-profit organisation that maintains three historic theatres in Seattle. That's where it is, isn't it, or close by? Mark welcomed the new album Ghosts by Joe Bailey, who's the first artist to be signed to Mark's own record label, and you can hear his first single in that post. In the community posts, as is the tradition, let's start with Jeffrey Mason's Weekly Haul, which this time contains a 1970 review of the first Yes album, a 1970 report of Peter Banks moving post-Yes to Bloodwin Pig, who changed their name to simply Bloodwin after they realised that they would acquire the nickname Piggy Banks. Chris Welch's report on the chaotic Irish tour of July 1969, which featured Yes as well as The Nice and the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. American Rocker's Heart explaining their Yes influences. A Spotify playlist of Bill Bruford's inspirations. A selection of Jeff Down's works, including DBA. Several vintage Yes posters. A review of the Eagles and Yes from 1972, and a review of a Tales tour concert from 1974. That Jeff Bailey character has been taking part in a podcast all about Union's 30th anniversary with John Kirkman and Roy Avin. And Mark Lang sent along a link to a classical composer reacting to Close to the Edge. Those videos are always fun. Bill Kilmer added an interview with Phil Collins from 1974 in which he tells the story of how he contacted John Anderson after Bill Bruford left the band to see if there was an opportunity to join. That could have been interesting. Adrian Bell's Progressive Alternative latest show includes John Anderson in Reissue Corner, which he says, of course, means animation plus a tale of when he chose to chat to Jade Anderson at the Hammersmith Apollo stage door rather than her dad. Tony Handley spotted the 3D model of a Roger Dean-inspired landscape on YouTube, and he managed to persuade the guy who made it to sell it to him. Nice work, Tony. So many thanks, as always, to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week.
This is Miguel Falcón at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Established in 2011, this is Two Fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band.
After the sad news we shared last week about Phil Nero, Mark and I have decided to listen to parts of Yes songs this week and compare the performances with later live offerings. It's what we've done before in our Yes Tracks Through Time series. Most Yes fans agree that Yes songs captures the band at its best, and it often comes top in the best live albums, lists and polls. Over the years, a wide variety of different kinds of live albums have appeared, and as you may remember, Mark and I have discussed the proliferation of these in recent years. These later live albums feature obviously a great many different musicians and settings. There's the symphonic live orchestral version, the Yes Acoustic Project, the 8-man Union Live Extravaganza, the six-man House of Blues and ABWH lineups, and even the unfortunately short-lived Yes featuring Anderson, Rabin and Wakeman. So I've decided to listen to Long Distance Runaround on Yes songs and then compare it with a dramatically different Yes acoustic version from just 31 years later. After some detective work by fans and others, it's widely agreed that the recording of Long Distance Runaround, which appears on Yes songs, is from February 1972 at the Academy of Music in New York. Inexplicably, the recording locations are not noted on the triple record package itself. So we have the fragile lineup of Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe and Squire. And Rick starts us off with that introduction we know so well. Howe jumps in and then the whole band, and it's fizzing with electricity and motion, a groove like no other, and sparkling in its attitude. Every note is precise, and Howe's much more distorted guitar sound is obvious. Anderson's voice cuts through beautifully, and Squire's bass is blistering. The tightness of Bruford's drumming in conjunction with stabs of Wakeman keys is extraordinary, and the way it swings back into the riff is mesmerising, as are Howe's extra curlicues which embellish his line in a way he has completely stopped doing, as far as I can see, during live performances today. Back we go to the verse with some classic Squire backing vocals augmenting Anderson's peerless tones. We are reminded of the genius of this period of the band's music, the deceptively simple lines from each instrumentalist and vocalist, which meld together in almost transparent beauty to form a whole far more exquisite than the sum of its parts should be. I'm particularly appreciating Bruford's spare and sparse but perfectly judged percussion. There is a clarity and beguiling elegance to this music, like the finest, clearest cut diamond. Being Yes, this is next broken down into a dream sequence of repeated cascading Howe figures steeped in reverb, which works its way out to begin the introductory passage to The Fish. It's an extraordinary performance with so much finesse and energy packed into just 4 minutes. Amazing stuff. Fast forward 31 years and we have a unique Yes event. Yes Acoustic, guaranteed no hiss, is the DVD package released after a simulcast, which involved the band playing a fully acoustic set in front of 100 people in a studio in California, and this being broadcast live to cinemas or film theatres, whichever you prefer, around the US. This was the second part of a Yes event, which also featured a 75-minute version of the documentary Yes Speak. The original running time is 190 minutes, but that includes audio-only elements, I believe. The only change in personnel from the Yes Songs version of Long Distance Runaround is in the percussion department, with Alan White taking Bill Bruford's role. Wakeman is improvising on the theme of Long Distance Runaround under Anderson's commentary, and then that piano and guitar figure appears. Howe is seated with an acoustic guitar, and Anderson strums along on another. Squire has an impossibly long-necked acoustic bass guitar, and there's just a piano for Wakeman. Alan White plays Bruford's parts similarly to the original but adds his own touches and feel. Everything kicks off with a superb bass line fizzing underneath the iconic fast guitar part, and this is one of the songs which works really brilliantly in this format. Squire and Anderson vocals are just as effective as on Yes songs and blended beautifully with Howe's, the classic Yes choir, and the whole thing is very enjoyable indeed. I remember the acoustic interlude in the following 2004 performance at the NEC in Birmingham really well, and I particularly enjoy hearing Squire's different bass tone in this arrangement. There's no elaborate Howe dream sequence solo, and it all comes to an end quite soon, which is a shame, but they did need to display a variety of songs in a short time, so that's understandable. So I think I did rather well with my choice. Both renditions are great in their own ways. Obviously, the Yes Songs one is fast, furious and exciting, and the acoustic one is much more mellow, but proves the quality of the music and the musicians, as it works just as well for me.
Greetings, friends. So after last week's sad news about Phil Narrow passing away, me and Kevin thought it might be a good idea, or a nice idea, to do something based around Yes Songs, the album, and that was the tribute act that Phil Narrow was in. They were called Yes Songs. So what we decided to do this week is to choose one song from the Yes Songs album and then compare it to a version of the same song that they performed later on, with either various different members or a version that is radically different from the version that's on the Yes Songs album. So the song I decided to choose was Close to the Edge. Now, I remember the very first time I heard Close to the Edge from the Yes Songs album. I thought it was a fantastically performed song. More importantly, I also ended up finding a VHS copy back in the day of Yes songs and was absolutely mesmerized by the live performance that I saw. They had that, you know, if you guys remember that circular sort of disco light thing that they had where it flashed all the lights around, and they had the, you know, the very long intro with the water and all that. So I was really captivated by this performance. And compared to the studio version of the song, the Yes songs version was so upbeat and fast, and it was just amazing to hear them perform this at such a blistering pace. I mean, it's definitely a challenging song to play even at the normal tempo that they did on the studio version. So to perform this as accurately and as fantastically as they did on Yes songs is just something to behold. I've always been impressed by Steve's guitar work in this song. Chris Squire's bass playing is amazing. The vocals, just fantastic. And Rick Wakeman's keyboard playing, of course, is something that's, you know, worth noting, especially the whole middle section with the church organ part. And I mean, lots of people have listed this song, as well as the album, obviously, as quite possibly the greatest progressive album ever released. And the song Close to the Edge, quite possibly one of the greatest songs ever written within the genre. So when I chose this song, I had to think for a minute of what performance of this song really stuck out to me. It didn't have to be necessarily a better one or something really odd. I just wanted to pick one that really stood out to me as far as having the same effect almost as when I watched the original version, the Yes song, one that I mentioned on VHS. What performance stood out like that in my mind? And there's one that comes immediately to mind, and that is the performance that they did, I believe, in 2000 or 2001 when they performed it on the symphonic tour. Now, I remember once again when I saw this DVD release at the music store, Yes Symphonic, Yes Plays with Symphonic Orchestra Live. I brought it home, put it on the 5.1 system, and listened to it. And the fact that it was the opening song of the show as well, to me, is quite daring. I mean, not many bands are going to open with a 20-minute piece in a concert, but I think it was quite possibly the best move they could have done, because not only did it introduce the band proper, but it gave them a good piece to, you know, showcase this orchestra that they were playing with, because I think the orchestra did such a magnificent job on this song. I mean, I'm sure everybody who has seen this has to agree that it's just a standout performance. What song better to have a symphony orchestra backing than this one? I think when they were in studio doing these parts and recording all the keyboards, I think they probably had something like that in mind, envisioning that some of these keyboard parts that Rick put down could have been parts that they could have did with an orchestra in a studio. So I think that's why it translated so well when they performed it this way in this concert. I mean, the strings were perfect. All the brass stuff was spot on. They had lots of percussion. They had harp and all those subtle parts in the middle when Rick was doing all the organ parts. Now, that's another thing to point out. Rick wasn't playing keyboards in this. It was the fantastic Tom Brislin who played it, and he did another standout job on this. Tom Brislin etched his name in Yes history with this performance. I mean, there are so many moments in this concert that he did that were so great. I mean, the keyboard solo in Starship Trooper, I mean, come on. If you haven't seen his version of that, just for the sake of, you know, solidifying my comment, check that song out. You won't be disappointed. But I definitely think that Close to the Edge is one of those performances that immediately takes me back to that moment of when I saw the very first time Yes songs, or heard Yes songs, and when they performed Close to the Edge on that. The impact that it had on me was pretty much the same, I have to say, because the orchestra just added so much. And I think I also had the benefit of having 5.1 surround as well to hear it. I mean, it just added so much more, that sort of, you know, sound staging when it was so nicely spread out and it fills the room so nicely with that orchestra. It was a fantastic performance. And I definitely think that it's one that should be listened to by every Yes fan. So that's my thought on Close to the Edge. So now let's go over to Kevin, and we'll talk about our picks.
Mark is here with me now to have a talk about Yes songs and later live recordings. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing very well. The new dog that I have, Shadow, has been giving us a little bit of trouble, but today I'm pleased to announce that he slept through the entire night. I discovered the secret. The secret is, let him jump on the bed and sleep beside me the whole night, and I will have no trouble at all to sleep through the night. So that mystery solved.
Yeah, that sounds awfully familiar to me with my two dogs as well. It's a bit of a pain, but they don't make any fuss. I definitely think they're human. But anyway, that's off the point. Back to Yes songs and later recordings. And it was nice to focus on two songs from the kind of classic era of the band for a change, so Close to the Edge and Long Distance Runaround. And what always strikes me when I listen back to Yes songs or any live recordings from that era is just how different the band sounds to going to hear them today. Not that I'm saying that going to hear them today is wrong or bad or it's not an enjoyable experience, but it's a different kind of band, isn't it now?
Yeah, I mean, the whole Yes songs thing, I mean, you can tell that they were very young. They were still very much trying to prove a point, I think, to themselves and to the music world in general. I mean, just listen to the tempos that they were playing some of these songs at. It was like they were on fire, these guys. And then, you know, later on, I think Yes fell into that kind of bracket where a lot of these other bands started doing this as well, is where they started finding themselves really following and committing themselves to an actual metronome type performance, yeah, where everything was a little bit slower, but, you know, very still technically correct. You know, that's the one thing about those kind of performances. You can tell that they're very, very, like, they're very connected to that metronome to the point of where there's no fluctuation. Mm-hmm. Everything is played as perfectly as they can. And, you know, a little bit of the feel, I think, is lost from that, but they're still fantastic performances. So I think that's why people like Yes songs so much, is because of that fire that you hear.
Yes, you certainly do. And it reminded me of the days of, you know, Peter Banks in those earliest recordings, because it had that same kind of, as you said, youthful exuberance and so on. But a couple of the things which have changed quite a bit, I wanted to ask you about, and we've spoken about them before, and they're both relating to Steve Howe, because I think Steve Howe was one of the main movers when Yes started playing full albums again, and the to stick as close to the record as possible. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is Steve Howe's guitar sound, and we definitely have talked about that before. So we'll come back to his guitar sound in a minute. But before that, do you think that's got anything to do with audiences wanting something different from the band now? Back in Yes Songs days, they wanted to, you know, as much speed and as much excitement and fire as possible. But now the audience is much more familiar with the records themselves, and they want to, when they go and hear them in concert, they want to hear very close to the record.
Yeah, I think that's exactly, like, you know, you hit the nail on the head sort of thing, because I think that by this point, the fans that have stuck with them and that are going to these concerts, you know, they're so familiar with these records, but while they're familiar with them, listening to them at home on their stereo system, a lot of these songs before were not necessarily played live, or if they were played live, they were done live at a time when maybe they weren't going to see the band at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, seeing songs, you know, that, you know, haven't been played in a, you know, donkey's years, you know, I mean, people were getting excited, you know, when they say you're going to do Fragile in its entirety. I mean, I don't think, you know, Cans and Brams has been played many times live, right?
No.
So even though it's a little minor piece, but still, people haven't heard that in a long time. You know, the people haven't heard Adventure from, you know, Fragile as well. From the Yes album in a long time as well. So when that was played, that was, you know, a big thing too. So I think it's just people wanted to have something a little bit different. And the idea of playing whole albums did start becoming popular around that time period as well, from other bands as well. So I think that it was a good idea, because a lot of these people wanted to hear these records played in full.
Yes, that's right. And it does sort of hark back for those of us who remember those days when you used to buy an album and put it on the turntable and sit down and listen to it end to end, very much different to what my children do now. Not particularly one of them, but the other two definitely are more interested in individual songs and having a playlist and even having a playlist on random shuffle. That's the word I'm trying to find. So very different experience and wanting very different things, I suppose. And yes, when I did go to those full album concerts, I very much did enjoy hearing what they did, what they could do with some of those records start to finish. So I think, yes, there's a place for all of those. But going back to this Steve Howe guitar sound thing, and is that part of the trying to get back to the records? Or do you think he doesn't actually play in the same sorts of ways with the same sorts of sounds as he did on those records originally? And certainly, that's something which really stuck out to me when I listened to Yes songs this week, was, and I've heard lots of people talking about it, is his guitar tone is so much cleaner now, and there seems to be very little distortion. I mean, I don't know what the technical terms are, but it certainly seems a lot cleaner now, and it wasn't back in Yes songs, and that's the recording that people point to as the greatest ever. So what's going on with his sound?
Well, to put it clearly, I think part of it has to do with technology. Part of it has to do with what they could do back then as compared to what they can do now. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, there was an excellent video on YouTube that Premier Guitar did where they right. talked with Steve Howe and they talked to Chris Squire and they went through their live touring rig.
Yeah.
Now, Steve Howe makes a very strong point about saying that he uses Line 6 pretty much exclusively as far as amplification and as far as his outboard effects. He has a pedal board that Line 6 makes. It's called a Pod XT Live.
Right.
And it has all the effects inside. There has your overdrive, your distortion, your chorus, your flanging, delays, reverbs, everything under the sun you have there. In 1972, to have as much stuff that's in that unit on the floor, he would have probably took up 3/4 of the stage just in pedals alone. Right. And not only that, but half of those things probably they didn't even have made in pedal form, probably back when they were touring those things, you know?
Mm.
And if they did, they were probably really, you know, very basic cavemanish kind of, you know, contraptions.
Yeah.
So, and you know, he mentions in that video that him and his roadie guy, his name, you know, kind of disappears from my mind right now, but whoever his tech guy was at that time, they would sit down at Steve's place, they put the album on, and they went through each song section by section. Okay, what did I play here in the introduction? Wow, what is the sound that I'm using?
Yeah.
And they made individual patches for each song, for each section, because on each patch, you have 4 pedals. So you can say, okay, patch number 1 is Yours Is No Disgrace. Right. Pedal number 1 is for the verse. Pedal number 2 is for the chorus sound. Pedal number 3 is my solo sound. And pedal number 4 is my special effects sound. Right. And he does that for each song. So he can really fine-tune and pinpoint the kind of sounds he wants for what part of the song. Now, again, doing that kind of detail back in 72 or 71 or 73 just wasn't going to happen, you know?
Mm.
If that back then it was pretty much bring your best guitar, your best amp, which he pretty much was using those Fender silver face or the black face ones, and, you know, just pray that you can get it as good as possible. Because even his clean sounds and some of the cleaner tones that he used back then, that was more about him just rolling down the volume on his guitar to get, you know, not as much drive out of it to make it cleaner. Now it's just a matter of pushing a button and he has a beautiful, shimmery, clean sound, or he can just bring over his acoustic guitar that's plugged in and play that. So a lot of it is technology. I mean, right now you can make your stuff sound as pristine live as you did in studio.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. Yes, thank you. That's given me a very different viewpoint on that then, and I can see how with the sort of extended palette that you've got now, that things could be a lot better. And that did occur to me, thinking back to Queen in 1980s, and I remember watching the video of Live in Rio, which is incidentally I think the same year as Yes played Live in Rio. Anyway, and I do remember, I think my sister or my wife, but she wasn't my wife then, pointing out that a lot of the songs, even, you know, with Queen, sounded quite similar. And that was down to, and that was 1984, not 1974. And that was down to, I suppose, what was possible on stage. And, you know, you've got your Red Special guitar if you're Brian May. You've got your Fender bass or whatever it is, and there isn't a lot you can do to change radically what those sounds like are like on stage and live perhaps. So that's fascinating. So I don't know. Maybe you might prefer the 73 sound for a whole album, and we've got those 7 concerts, haven't we, from 73 on the Progeny. And. And, you know, people rave about those and the performances and the skill and the way the sound came across and the music came across, but nothing like what it was on the album. So, you fascinated me now. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you. Mark, let's get back to talking about the alternative versions that we listened to. And yeah, brilliant. We both independently chose two very, very different tours. So Symphonic Tour and the acoustic set, which was done for that DVD, for that live broadcast that they did. And then they incorporated that into some live concerts after that as well. That version of the band, as it were, forming themselves up at the front of the stage with acoustic instruments, which was absolutely great fun. But yes, I think you're right. I mean, that Symphonic Tour, we've talked about it many times before, but just the quality of those arrangements, and we've spoken to Tom Brislin about it as well on the show, the quality of those orchestral arrangements and the way that the orchestra is integrated into the music and backs the band up and doesn't swamp the band. And it's just, you know, some of the best orchestral arrangements of rock music or orchestral augmentations of rock music that I've ever heard. And being lucky enough to hear the thing live as well, it really was an amazing experience. And then having Tom Brislin to add those bits that you needed in of soloing, etc., on the keyboards, just everything came together, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always enjoyed that live concert. And one thing that I think that's very important to make note of is that while, you know, a lot of bands do these kind of things, a lot of bands don't do them as well as I think Yes did, because I think a lot of the Yes songs do lend themselves to using orchestra in it. And, you know, but keep in mind, they were very, very selective about the songs that they did play with the orchestra. Mm. I mean, you can't imagine a record like 90125 having a lot of orchestra backing on it. It's just not that kind of a record. No. Same with Big Generator. It just doesn't seem like an album that would lend itself well to that. But you have an album like Relayer or an album like Close to the Edge. And I mean, that's why I picked the song Close to the Edge, because that whole song lends itself so perfectly to the orchestra stuff, like all those little stabs they do in the verses. And they have that little brass shot that's in there, right? You know, it's like perfect, you know? Yeah. And the whole middle section, I mean, they have the, you know, the use of the harp, and they have xylophone and these lovely strings, and, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that they can use in that whole middle section before Mr. Brislin comes in and does the whole organ bit in the middle. I mean, that song is just well made for it. I mean, same with the Gates of Delirium. It's the same thing, same kind of approach. But then, like I said, you can't imagine them doing like Hold On from 90125 and having orchestra in there. Like, well, what could they have possibly done? You know,
And that's, you know, it strikes me that we were so lucky to be able to hear, and so lucky to be able to have the DVD of some of those epic pieces treated in this way. And, you know, will they ever be done in that way again? I wouldn't have thought so. Certainly not with that same Yes lineup, of course, now that Chris is gone and Anderson not there. So I'm sure they will never do that kind of thing again in the same way. So it really was a remarkable thing to be able to do. And you mentioned the 5.1 sound experience. Now, I've never had a 5.1 setup. You need some kind of particular setup, don't you, for that experience?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you just need to get yourself a proper DVD player, which most of them are capable of that, obviously. It's more or less your receiver that you need that has to be 5.1 compatible, because you need a center speaker, a left-right speaker, which most stereo systems have. You need a subwoofer channel, and you need the back, left, and right as well. So just to fill you in on what you're potentially missing or not missing, basically all it is that if you have your stereo set up, let's say you have a chair in the middle of the room and you're facing the TV, your center speaker is right over the television, and then you have your left, right to the either side of it, and then you have your subwoofer on the ground, and then you have your left, right speakers behind you, preferably behind your seat, left, right. Now, the thing is, on this recording, if memory serves me correctly, because I haven't set up my 5.1 in ages since I moved, but the thing is, it's just like listening to it in stereo for the most part, except that when you have audience bits, or if they had some sort of special effect that they decided to do in some sort of sweeping 360 sound, mainly the back speakers are for audience and stuff like that, or the reverberation of the hall and stuff like that. Like, that's why like 5.1 for studio albums, I think, is better, because they can really use the 5.1 and do all kinds of crazy effects stuff with it, right? But for live, they kind of seem to use it for like making a recreation of what it would have been like sitting in the actual hall.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I understand that then. But yeah, it's something that I need to do, need to set up for myself at some point. It sounds great fun anyway. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was the symphonic version of Close to the Edge, which is really wonderful stuff. And let's just go on to the long-distance runaround. Totally, totally different. You couldn't get further away from an orchestral version of long-distance runaround than this, because they've stripped everything away, including the electronics. I do think long-distance runaround gets a bit of an unfair treatment sometimes, and people tend to underrate it, I think, when compared with things like Heart of the Sunrise and Roundabout and all those sorts of things. But I think the way that the instruments fit together is just as good as those other songs. And these two performances, I did think, gave me sort of double the chance to experience how it all fits together. And I do think it's the mark of great music, like Close to the Edge, that it does stand being performed in different contexts and arrangements and still works beautifully as music. So, yeah, I do love the acoustic. It's slightly, I've always thought that Steve Howe seemed uncomfortable on that, and I did read him saying that he was much more nervous when he was sitting down and standing up to play the acoustic stuff than he is at a normal concert, and it's something a bit different. But what do you think of acoustic versions, and what other bands do you know who have done really great acoustic versions of things? I'm thinking of the old MTV days when they did Unplugged, and one that I remember particularly was Eric Clapton's Unplugged stuff, which was fantastic. So what's your opinion of these acoustic treatments?
Well, I don't mind the acoustic treatments, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I think there came a time, like you mentioned, with the whole MTV Unplugged, where it became, you know, the thing to do. Like, you know, if you haven't been on MTV Unplugged, then, you know, you're just not hip. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At that time. But I think that you're right in a few things here. After rewatching this, you know, Yes Acoustic Guaranteed No Hiss, you know, DVD that I have, you can definitely tell that Steve Howe doesn't seem quite in his element. I mean, when you watch him playing, he's always looking around, looking at the other people. Am I playing? And, you know, it almost seems like he's wondering if he's in time with them or not. Like, he just doesn't seem comfortable doing it. Whereas you have Rick, who's just in his element, his eyes closed, playing the piano. And he was the star of that, to be honest.
Yes.
Rick Wakeman's piano playing was just absolutely brilliant in there. And John Anderson has said numerous times during that performance, he goes, oh, that's just wonderful, Rick. Like, he just really points out Rick's playing.
Yeah.
And Chris Squire did some great stuff. I mean, even him, he's not exactly known for acoustic bass playing. So, but, and you watch him, he's using a kind of a small, this is Steve Howe now I'm talking about. He's having a kind of smaller scale acoustic guitar that he's sitting down and playing with. And what he plays is fine. I don't think he did anything necessarily wrong in there. Like, he played everything fantastically well. But you can definitely tell that it seemed a little, you know, almost last minute in feel. Like, it almost seems like when they were doing it, he was almost like expecting for something to go wrong during that, you know? Because if you watch that documentary that accompanies it, and it shows the whole build-up towards the performance of it, there was a lot of things that were going on up to the last second. So I know that Steve Howe wasn't into that kind of preparation, you know?
Now, to
answer your other thing about bands that have done it, one of my favorite bands, I'm sure you've probably heard of them, Queensryche. They did a fantastic MTV performance where they did Silent Lucidity and some of these other songs that they're known for. And that's really good. But one of my favorite ones, and this might come as a complete shock to you, one of my favorite performances on MTV Unplugged, and I have it on CD, is Neil Young. Young did a great performance of it where it was mainly him alone on stage. He had a bunch of acoustics, like a 12-string, a 6-string. He had his slide dobro. He had his, you know, his connecting harmonica piece so he could play guitar and do the harmonica. And he had this really odd organ on stage and stuff like that. And a lot of it was really, really well done. Like, he did, you know, Needle the Damage Done, you know, all these classic songs of his, Pocahontas and stuff like that. And then later on near the end of it, he brought up a few more people and they did, like, you know, like more fuller band arrangements, but in acoustic still. So I'm not a big Neil Young fan. I've never been much into his singing style. So, but I think on that, it really fit well. I think that more than anything on headphones, the feel of that concert is just absolutely spellbounding, in my opinion, when you just listen to it on headphones. So if you want to hear a good performance of it and want to get lost in the kind of vibe of it, get yourself a good pair of headphones and put on Neil Young's MTV.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you are. That's a good recommendation there. And yeah, I like it. And I did love seeing that segment of the live show shortly after they did this acoustic DVD. And I do think that Steve was much more comfortable. But I couldn't agree more with what you say about Rick Wakeman. And that's definitely his, you know, his perfect instrument, his perfect situation. And he's done so many wonderful arrangements of Yes songs and other music over the years just on solo piano. And it really is, you know, he's a master of that. And the rest of the band, perhaps with the exception, as we say, of Steve Howe, did extremely well as well. And I suppose they are all characters who are much more relaxed than Steve. He likes everything to be absolutely precise, and he's got an elaborate pre-concert regime that he always goes through, and he certainly wasn't able to do that on this occasion. So absolutely no problem with that at all. Still really, really enjoyable. And the comic narration that Rick Wakeman does over the preparation stuff is great fun. Okay, great stuff. So I really enjoyed listening to those different versions of those songs this week, and thank you, Mark, for your wonderful pieces of technical instruction today in the podcast. That's been brilliant. So if you like those arrangements, different versions of these live recordings, then do let us know. If you know of any other really good unplugged versions, or what about symphonic versions of other music, then do get in touch and tell us about that on the show notes for this week. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulrine and Mark Anthony Kay.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Wayne Hall, Preston Frazier, and Jeffrey Cresselius. And half of those Yes Music Podcast patrons are Alan Begg. That's Alan Begg. Mark James Lang, Aaron Steelman, Martin Kelberg, Bob Martellotta, Michael O'Connor, Brian Sullivan, Miguel Falcao, Chris Bandini, Neil Caffrey, Craig Estenes, Paul Hales, Dave Owen, Paul Tomei, David Hayden, Paul Wilson, Lind, Dave Pannell, Lobate Scarp, Dave Watkinson, Rachel Hadaway, Dem, Mark Zarkol Bags, Doug Curran, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, Scott Colombo, Fred Barringer, and Scott Smith. As always, continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those producers and patrons. If you'd like to join them in keeping the lights on here at the new and improved YMP Towers, then please do go over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or click on the links on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week, as I always say. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back again next week. In the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.